Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. About a decade ago, Ben Hewitt wrote the book, The Town That Food Saved, about Hardwick. In another Northeast Kingdom town, they're writing their own story. You might call this one The Town That Art Revived. The town is Linden, and the group working to pump new life and pride into it is called Linden Downtown Revitalization. The shorthand is LDRC. Joining me to talk about Linden and the art movement that will make this town create again is Martha Elms. She's a board member for LDRC. Martha Elms, thank you for joining us on Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. How are you doing?
I'm great. Listeners, I'd love to hear from you about what the arts can mean to a community or your thoughts on the art scene in the kingdom. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email them to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Martha Elms, it's got NVU Linden, Linden Institute, the Miss Lindenville Diner. Now really introduce us to Linden.
Well, Linden has a really, really strong history of pretty interesting history. I mean, we have T.N. Vale and Elmer Darling, people who were the founders in the 1800s who came and brought Italian artisans into our area to build buildings and do sculptures and create our local economy. And they did it through artisans. And so we're sort of picking up where they left off. I mean, some of the structures and the architecture that they put into our town, you know, really is amazing. T.N. Vale was the founder of AT&T. And so, you know, had deep pockets and loved Linden and brought money to us. So we're sort of picking up the art piece from where, you know, where it's all begun. You know, we've been trying really hard to bring different types of art into our community, extra new art, and community involvement. And it's hard, Rick. It really is, you know, because we're working on a shoestring, but and, you know, we write a lot of grants, but we think it's important, so we continue.
Well, it's obvious now that Linden has deep roots with the arts, but what else makes it a special place?
I think we have a really strong community. It's not a gorgeous little town, but then when you look past the things that have deteriorated, you see that it really has good bones. And it's like a good piece of furniture or, you know, a good piece of clothing. You sort of know it's got some good structure to it. And we recognize that. So, our, you know, LDRC's irritation was looking at our downtown and seeing empty storefronts. I think that's the plight of all of our little towns, you know, as stores empty and windows become, you know, dirty and empty, and it's depressing. And so we have started by putting artwork in windows. It's not a genius move or anything. I mean, it's a pretty easy thing for a community to do, but we've added artwork in windows so that I think our main intention was to show potential renters or businesses that, hey, this looks really good, you know, that downtown could look really nice. Maybe we'll move in and do it. And so we have been successful. We've had a few businesses coming in where we have just, you know, done simple things like putting artwork in windows.
Well, Martha Elms, how did Linden lose that mojo?
I don't know. You know, how did any of our towns in Vermont lose the mojo? I think it has a lot to do with money. You know, where the money's coming from. You need people who are going to invest in our towns. We have just up the road, we have Kingdom Trails Association. It's a huge influx of tourism and money into our community. As we, LDRC, got together and talked about our future and of Linden, we recognized that all of these people, hundreds of thousands of people come through, you know, on a yearly basis, 2 years, go right through Linden. They aren't stopping. they're just keep on going. So how are we going to get them to stop? You have to make something that's attractive and stimulating for a tourist to say, you know, hey, I'm going to take a photo next to that. So, so you know, we did two. We have two gigantic murals in town. A lot of towns are doing murals, but it is something that draws attention. You know, it makes people stop and look at them, and when they stop, then they, you know, buy a cup of coffee and they get a sandwich and they look around a little bit and they walk the street. I mean, everything kind of links together. That's why we're trying to do this.
Tell us about those murals.
Well, number one was quite a process. We had a young couple with young kids, you know, the kind of what we feel is the future of our community. But they had a big wall behind what was the existing railroad station. So it was very recognizable. They had a Cumberland Farms that was torn down, and so it was a big parking lot. And it was an eyesore. So we decided to put the mural on these people who were very receptive to having this gigantic mural. We took the theme of the bikes and our railroad history. We have a really strong railroad history in Linden. And we put the gears, and it's very, you know, abstract, but, you know, it's the gears and wheels and whatever. And it's probably 70 feet long, brightly colored, and everyone pulls in and takes photos there. I mean, it just seems that we have bike racks there so they can bike in and take photos. That's number one. We had from Burlington actually come over. We did a call to artists to find out who could do it, and that was our option. And so that was number one. Number two is on the back of the electric department, a huge, ugly cement wall. It's just one of those things that you can't stand, and you can overlook it, but a local artist, Larry Golden, did four seasonal panels. Again, it's about 70 feet long, but of the village, so it's very realistic. It's not a but it shows the history, and also a large portrait of T.N. Vail, who was our founder, who's the one who had the deep pockets and put, a lot of money behind some of the, you know, more beautiful structures and Bandstone Park and whatever in our town. So that was number two. Now we just did number three, and we're looking for a place to put it.
So, excellent.
So
it's growing. Hey, let's take a call from Ellie, and I think you know Ellie. She says she works with you. So good morning, Ellie, and welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Ellie, what's your role in all of this?
Well, I work alongside Martha with LDRC and at the Satellite Gallery in downtown Lindenville, helping to put up shows and organize art walks. But I also am a trustee on the Brooklyn Arts Council, which is celebrating our 50th year and for which we did the mural just recently. And it's just another example of the support that our area gives the arts, that for 50 years we've had an organization that raises money through two juried craft shows a year to support the arts in our schools and communities. We put, you know, thousands, sometimes upwards of $15,000 into our schools to help our teachers get the art supplies they need and to help support visiting guest artists coming and working with our students and supporting the Vermont Children's Theater and just other things that enrich our area so much. There's always more to do, but, you know, we've been around and we will be around.
Ellie, what area does Berkland serve? Is that Burke and Linden, or is there a wider area?
It's a wider area. Yeah, we serve all of the schools in the Kingdom East School District. So hopefully I get them all. But it's Sutton and Newark and Burke and Linden and Sheffield, Miller's Run. But then also recently Concord and Lunenburg are added to that list. Plus we serve the the private schools in the area, so Riverside School and Thaddeus Stevens, and then also organizations within that area can apply for money.
And also Linden Institute.
Yep.
Linden Institute, right, the high school and Eastbrook School.
And Martha, Ellie mentioned the satellite gallery. So tell us a little bit about what that is and how that came to be.
Oh, it actually is really, it's kind of a fun story. I mean, we, as I said, we've been doing these windows and decorating the windows. A building had been empty for, I think, almost 7 months. Right on the corner, great visibility, beautiful bay windows. It used to be the post office in town, and the woman who owns the building came to us and said, could you just put some, you know, art, continue, because our art walk is generally only in November, but she said, would you put some art in my windows? So we did a pop-up gallery, and, you know, just by chance, it was so popular. People were just so into it, and, you know, were excited, and they came out from all the different townships to our art opening, and it just had a great vibe to it. And so we continued. So we decided, okay, let's just do another show. And it became another show. And more people came and listened to music, and it just sort of evolved into this nice community center, which is what our goal was, is to make a spot that was filled with art that could become a location for meetings, so you could be surrounded by art and have a small meeting, which we've done many of, and or have music, or Ellie actually taught life drawing classes on Thursdays, and we had, you know, a nice turnout of people coming in and doing life drawing. I mean, so I felt like we were giving back. We had this gallery that was beautiful, and when you drive by at night, it's all lighted up, so it's just, I mean, it makes the town look warm and welcoming. But then we also provide stuff, you know, we give back, you know, so it's really kind of I guess I'm really, really biased, and that's, but I really, really love it. I love the gallery. I think it's a real asset.
Ellie, before I let you go, what role do you think art has in the fabric of a town?
Well, I mean, I guess on the basic level, you know, art is just one of those things that is distinctly human, and it's one of those things that you don't have to hold yourself back from appreciating about us. And I think that it can bring a town life and tourism and a sense of pride that can be lost, you know, when things start to deteriorate or you don't have the money to make every store front or building beautiful. When you have beautiful things to gather around, it leaves you with a good feeling about a place.
Well, Ellie, thanks for calling us and letting us know about Berklin and about LDRC. Thanks so much. And Martha, draw me the schematic that takes us from Linden when you started, adding the arts, and where you see the town at the end of this journey.
Oh, boy, that's tough.
You can do it very briefly.
Yeah, well, just I think what we're hoping is that we follow up on Vermont Arts Council and the Vermont Creative Network did a study Cindy Freed. From Catamount Arts was very instrumental in pulling this together as well. But just about our creative economy in the Northeast Kingdom, which is what we are trying to link ourselves to keep bringing that creative economy and to our area. So what I see in the future is a link between all of these organizations. We do it now. We're all scratching each other's backs for sure. But we have... you know, we have Catamount Arts, we have the Vermont Children's Theater, we have Northern Vermont University, Linden, with the graphic arts department as the largest enrollment at the whole university. I mean, so we have these people in place. Now if we can just bring them all together. And that was one thing that I'm hoping is that we will be able to connect with NVU more. They can certainly use our help, and we can use their help. I think with all the college systems, you know, can use a help. But getting everybody to work together to make events. Catamount is very instrumental on bringing music and using spaces. We have a outing club that would be perfect for a music venue. That's the vision. We have, larger, organizations that, we'd like to link onto with libraries and dance.
Martha, I'm going to stop you for just a moment because help is on the way. Jody Freed of Catamount Arts is on the line, and we'll talk to Jody now. And hi, Jody, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Tell me what can be done through the arts to help a town like Linden.
Well, Linden is perfectly positioned, as Martha said, to really take advantage of its history, and the fact that it was really built on arts and culture, but also the fact that it is, its proximity with the recreation and the local food scene. So one of the things that we have found through all of our research with Catamount Arts and with the Vermont Creative Network, and we did a 110-page white paper in the last 18 months, with some of the folks that are really the experts in this area. And what they came up with is that the special sauce for our area, our rural communities in the Northeast Kingdom, is the intersection where creativity, recreation, and food meet. And Linden is just perfectly positioned to be able to take advantage of that unique circumstance because of the assets that are right there and surrounding it. So the other thing that came up in the study was the idea of hubs and the fact that in rural communities, you're going to have places where people convene and come together. And certainly Lindenville serves as a hub for lots of the surrounding towns. And Ellie was on earlier and coming down from Newark, Wheelock, Sheffield, Sutton, Burke, Kirby, the list goes on. Mm-hmm. But Lindenville is a hub for those towns. And so if you can create a place where there's resources and you can bring those resources together, then you get a catalytic effect where more can happen just because those things are brought together in a critical mass. So Linden is in a very strong position to make the creative economy a big part of their future and to build the community around that intersection of what has been there for literally hundreds of years, which is the irony of it.
Yeah, and I know Catamount Arts has done a great job of bringing events and arts to the NEK. So, Jody, thank you for calling, and thank you for the work that you do. Let's take another call.
Thanks, Jody.
Heather from St. Johnsbury. Heather, thanks for calling Vermont Viewpoint.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and I just wanted to say, Martha, thank you so much for everything you've done in Linden. The Satellite Gallery and the Art Walk have made a huge difference in that community. And I'm wondering, as an individual, how can I get involved, or how can I help? Sometimes it feels like we don't really know what to do. But I think I saw a GoFundMe. Is there anything individuals can do to help out?
Martha, you gotta love that.
Are you asking me? Well, Heather, I know what you do in St. Johnsbury, so kudos to you as well. We are all pulling on this together. We do have a GoFundMe right now. Solvent so that we can keep on providing these programs to our community. So that is one thing. We do have a GoFundMe now, but for the Satellite Gallery and for LBRC. But it's nice when I hear someone, those words of, how can I help? Mm-hmm. I mean, that is such a sweet sound. It really is a great thing. So thank you for saying that. And I'll get back to you on that.
Got to be music to Martha Elms' ears. We're going to take another call. Kaya is calling from Lindenville. Good morning, Kaya. Thanks for calling Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning. I just wanted to add my 2 cents worth to this important conversation. I think what Martha and the Revitalization Committee are doing is so important to this area that I volunteer a few hours a week to sit in the gallery and welcome visitors and just support what's going on because it's so important. And so that's my two cents worth. Build on what Martha and Jody and Heather and Ellie have all been saying this morning.
Oh, thank you, Kaya. And I do want to ask you, Martha, what have you seen from people who are coming into the satellite gallery there in Linden? Where are they coming from, and how are they reacting to the work that LDRC has done there in Linden?
Pre-COVID, there were a lot of summer people. We have a lot of lakes and summer houses and people, as I said, passing through with Kingdom Trail. So we'd have a lot of those people coming in and marveling at, first of all, the space, and then also in, you know, hearing that, you know, that evening something was going to happen at the college, or, you know, I mean, we were trying to create this network. You know, I think that we've had, with COVID, we've sort of, like everybody, you know, your doors are open, but, you know, you're limited in how many people are out and roaming around. We're trying to, the idea of the satellite, where we used to think that we were taking our, you know, pulling in from other communities and bringing people into the satellite work. Now we're trying to do the opposite and go out and do out of the brick and mortar, doing the mural project out of the lawn space. We have some plans to work with Jody at Catamount, you know, looking at potentials for, you know, music venues and you know, different projects. We've done pop-up foods. We had a Latin-inspired music.
Martha, we're almost out of time. Why don't you give everybody the website of Linden Downtown Revitalization?
It is. If you can go to Linden's Connection to the Kingdom on Facebook, that's a good link.
All right.
And that would work.
All right. Martha Elms, a board member of Linden Downtown Revitalization. Thanks for joining us this morning. We'll get an update from CBS News, then it's author Howard Norman. He'll tell us about his new graphic novel. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Our next guest is author Howard Norman. I got introduced to him with The Bird Artist. I wrote along with him in The Haunting of L. His memoirs in Fond Remembrance of Me and I Hate to Leave This Beautiful Place captivated me. Then he hit me with a novel noir called My Darling Detective and a lovely ode to Vermont in The Ghost Clause. Now Howard has written his first graphic novel, Detective Levy Detects, and it won't be his last. Howard Norman, it is great to have you on Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. Good to talk to you.
Now, listeners, you can speak with author Howard Norman by calling 244-1777, 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. Or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Howard, novels, memoirs, children's books. So why now a graphic novel?
Well, I hadn't intended to do this until I met Annie Basque, who is the co-owner and of Bohemian Bakery here in Montpelier, and started to be apprised of her wonderful gift as an artist. And we were just talking and concocting an idea, and I told her I was working on a noir set in Montpelier, of all places. Not necessarily associated with the world of noir, but in my imagination it is. And she said, let's work together, and it was as simple as that. And I started writing episode after episode after episode. So we're hoping it will be 10 in all of at least these main characters. Of course, including practically everyone I know in Vermont.
That is the great thing. You do find in the Ghost Clause and in Detective Levy Detects some Vermonters you actually know, which I love. Now, My Darling Detective is a wonderful novel noir in which your characters listen to a radio serial called Detective Levy Detects. So tell people a little bit about that book and the radio show.
Well, that book's set in Halifax. Many of my novels were set in the Canadian Maritimes. And I really wanted to have a couple who essentially during the day did whatever jobs they did, librarian and detective, but at night entered the world of radio. And radio in their lives imported the past into the present. So these were World War II era radio programs, and you know, which we can still hear today. I wanted that sort of emotional axis between various decades. And I've always been enamored of the radio. It was a childhood experience. My mother, may she rest in peace, raised four boys alone, and she used to have in our five-room house a radio on in each room. And I realized later that was just part of her sense of constructing some continuity in a very poor life. So she would move from room to room without any break in the radio broadcast. And I once asked her what seeing television for the first time was. And she said, without irony, well, Jack Benny was a lot better looking on the radio. And so it was formative for me, and it always has been. And radio's been a literal and metaphorical presence in an awful lot of my writing.
Yeah, on radio, I'm tall, handsome, and have a full head of hair. I remember you saying that you wrote radio scripts to refer to when you were writing My Darling Detective. So is this graphic novel and the future ones, are they from those scripts that you had written?
No, they're entirely new. The first radio scripts I wrote was way, way back with the now sadly deceased playwright Sam Shepard up in Nova Scotia. And I kept writing for radio at various intervals, but these are written essentially as a sequence of overlapping stories in which the entire life from courtship to marriage to having a child will take place between Detective Levy and Alexa Sands, the female protagonist, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so I have a novelistic structure in mind comprised of 10 chapters, each of which has a central episode. And iconically, the thing about Detective Levy is he has never solved a case. everyone around him sort of solves the case for him.
Right.
So it's really the journey and not the destination.
You mentioned you worked with illustrator Annie Basks on this project. How much different is that from just sitting in front of the keyboard and cranking out a book, or, you know, just doing it so solo?
I've had collaborations before. Mm. I was lucky to work with arguably the finest children's book illustrators, Leo and Diane Dillon, on two separate collections of folk tales. Between Heaven and Earth and The Girl Who Dreamed Only Geese. And working with them really was a highlight of a writing life for me. And, you know, I changed things in order to collaborate with their visual comprehension of what I was writing. And I suppose the cliche is that writers are solitary. They don't really work with anybody. They sit in rooms all day. Their social life is their fictional characters. Mm-hmm. But in that case, Leo and Diane were wonderful, wonderful companions traveling through time and space with me for about 4 or 5 years and over 2 collections. And so when Annie and I started to discuss this, I really felt, and I was very clear with her, that I wanted to do this for through the whole duration of 10 episodes. And she signed right on.
Nice.
And that's what we're doing. So the phenomenologically, collaboration was something I was somewhat familiar with, but not anything like this, because Annie's also a wonderful editor. So there's much more of a closer scrutiny of the writing as it relates to the illustrations. And now I find myself rewriting these episodes with her drawings in mind.
Oh, that's brilliant. You decided to self-publish this book. Why, Howard?
Well, we have some sponsorship, but I just wanted to keep it local. That may sound a little bit of a cliche, but, you know, when you go through New York Publishing and all the episodes may end up in that format, you lose a certain sense of aesthetic control. And working, Annie lives very close to where I live in Vermont, and, you know, I can drive over and we can go through things and just sit and brainstorm, really. It's a kind of perpetual, how did Proust say it, a perpetual refinement of a daydream. You set something forth and then you discuss it, and then it sort of changes, and what if, what if, what if. So I give her the basic text, and as she's doing the drawings, this is the way it's been so far, she makes suggestions, and I think that's an indispensable kind of intimacy between two people who think about the world very differently. I think narratively, and she thinks visually, if you will, and so it's the, I would prefer to use the word intimate rather than local.
I think some young writer right now just heard you say perpetual refinement of a daydream, and that is the title of their book. They're going to take that and write something splendid. Hey, we're going to pop out.
I stole that, though.
Yeah, isn't that great? And Howard, since I brought up Bear Pond Books, I'm going to keep asking you to tell this story until you tell me I must stop. But you were in front of Bear Pond Books, and it was a case of mistaken identity of another great Vermont writer.
Oh, yes, Howard Mosier.
Yeah.
A very old friend of mine. And I was standing in front of Bear Pond with friends, and a woman came out and said to me, and this never happens to me, you're my absolute favorite writer. If I go back inside and get one of your books, will you sign it? I said, of course. I was quite surprised. And she went back in and she brought out one of Howard Mosier's novels, which I signed quite effusively, actually. And then I called Howard up later in the day, and I told him this had happened. And Howard, being Howard, endlessly understated and laconic, asked me, was it a hard copy? And I said, yes. He said, well, that's the first one I've sold this month. So we always had a very good laugh about that. And, you know, he's sorely missed, yeah. Sorely missed.
Yeah, he really is. Just a wonderful writer, and still love going back and rereading some of his great works. A lot set here, right here in Vermont, as is The Ghost Clause, which I brought up earlier, a charming novel set in Calais. And I believe at the time when that came out, you said it would be your last novel. Are you sticking to that?
I am. It wasn't meant to have any dramatic import or be interesting to anyone. It came up in a conversation about the trajectory of a writing life, and I had just stopped thinking about, books organize your emotions, and there was just another way of thinking. I was starting to write a memoir about friendship and my friend Jake Bertot, the painter. But I guess you could say that Detective Levy Detects is novelistic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't quite want to call it a novel because, well, one has their own idiosyncratic definition of what that is. But it allows me to continue to think narratively in the way I would with a novel, but really build it around separate cases or episodes. And that is not how I would ever write a novel. So it's distinguished in that way. In aggregate, the 10 episodes might be seen novelistically, I suppose, but not by me, really.
Mm-hmm. Did I read that one of your books is being made into a movie?
I'm the last to know this. I didn't know this.
Oh, I could be making this up. I thought
yeah,
I saw this.
I wish you weren't making it up, but I think nothing like that has happened. Various things get optioned for a motion picture once in a while. I had somebody call the other day wanting to perhaps do Detective Levy as a sequence of radio scripts, and I'll see about that, but not with film so far, and it may never happen.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping to plant that seed for you, so that there's somebody out there who's going to say, you know, that would make a great movie.
Oh, well, I'm not holding my breath. Very different world, very different business than I'm interested in or know anything about, but it, sure. I mean, film is, of course, integral to these episodes because I keep referring to, I actually keep making up Richard Widmark films. And, you know, I have a friendship with Rick Winston, you know, extraordinarily erudite and brilliant guy about films, and Bill Barrett and others in town who all have said, now, I don't know those Richard Widmark films, and of course we fall over laughing. They don't exist.
Oh.
So they refer, and there are certain lines that I have taken of Richard Widmark's from his early but this is a lot of these are taken from sort of B movies, you know, the way the repartee that happens between men and women, especially, and old radio programs. And I am a real aficionado. I'm just glued to the set on Saturday nights at midnight to Noir Alley on the Turner Classics.
Well, consider myself fooled because I was going to go back through and write down the names of all those films and go back and watch them because they sound so wonderful in this graphic novel of yours. I'm thinking, boy, those lines, I've got to memorize them to use in life.
Well,
they're just fabulous.
That's a compliment. Thank you. I mean, you know, it can't, copyright stuff aside, it can be said that there was a certain way of writing in noir films, especially in the 1950s, in which there was a kind of cynicism, of severity of understatement, sadness, melancholy, all the things that linguistically as well as visually created a certain atmosphere.
Yeah. I get from reading Detective Levy Detects, I really get this feeling that you are still enjoying the heck out of writing. Am I right?
Very much enjoying it. You know, enjoyment is not a word one uses perhaps when you're in the midst of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just simply part habitual. You apprentice yourself to a certain way of thinking. But the real joy of this work, besides working with Annie, is that Montpelier transforms itself for me. I'm there, you know, maybe once a week, and I'm always sort of, I guess you would say, mentally auditioning possibilities. The second episode takes place to some extent in the Kellogg Hubbard Library. And so the idea is to write something that will allow, or one hopes will allow a reader to look at the things that are very familiar in a somewhat unfamiliar way.
Yeah. We're almost out of time, but I'm going to embarrass you with a great quote by E.L. Doctorow. And he said, both in his fiction and nonfiction, Howard Norman is a national treasure, that rarest of things, an original mind and writing original prose. Is he right? Can you really accept that kind of praise? I know you're a pretty modest person.
Oh, no, I don't. Edgar Doctorow was very generous. I think originality, I think, is a hard thing to put your finger on, but it is something I certainly look for in the writing I love most. Mm-hmm. Besides that, I was kind of stymied by that comment from such an estimable writer. And I hope he didn't regret it.
I don't think so. Howard Norman's new book is a graphic novel, Detective Levy Detects, and there are more to come, hopefully 9 more. Howard, it has been our pleasure to have you on Vermont Viewpoint this morning.
Thanks so much, Rick.
All right, take care. And after the CBS News, we get to chat with two weatherheads, Roger Hill and Dr. Jay Schaefer, here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
This is Vermont Viewpoint, and I'm your host, Rick Singeri. I've lived in Florida with its hurricanes. I spent years in the Midwest where tornadoes could touch down with ferocity. But I've never lived anywhere where people were so enamored with the weather. Following the weather in great detail is a favorite hobby with Vermonters. So for the next hour, we're going to have fun discussing weather and how it gets predicted. We'll discuss odd weather events, including that touch of Indian summer we just experienced the last week. Joining me is someone we're all quite familiar with here, Radio Vermont forecaster Roger Hill. Roger, thanks for being here. Do we have Roger? All right.
Hello.
Hey, there's our Roger. Okay. And NVU Linden Professor of Atmospheric Sciences, Dr. Jay Schaefer. Dr. Jay, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. It's good to be here.
All right. And listeners, if you'd like to ask Jay or Roger a question or share something funky weather-wise you've seen and that you'd like to have explained, you can call us at 244-1777. Toll-free, it's 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jay, when did you decide that this would be your calling?
Well, I was the kid on snow days growing up in the hills in New Jersey that was up at 5, 6 in the morning shoveling snow. And while everyone else was sleeping in, weather was something that caught my attention at a very early age. My dad certainly turned me on to nature, and weather was something that was always changing around me and found fascinating. And I always wanted to figure out why the clouds were changing and why it would rain or why it would snow instead. And that curiosity just naturally led me to want to pursue meteorology. And I would say that I had the weather bug at an early age, probably before the age of 10, but it wasn't really until high school. I was like, yeah, of course, it's going to be weather for me.
Mm. Where in the heck are there hills in New Jersey?
So in the suburbs away from New York City in Passaic County in a town called Wanacue, which is a small town by New Jersey standards. But we had hills that got up to, 1,000, 2,000 feet almost, and that was enough to change the weather from the coast to where we would get a little more snow than New York City might get skunked with rain.
Yeah. Roger, how about you?
Well, I'm a Californian and grew up in Southern California, so I came in into the very boring confines of Southern California, but what really kind of did it for me was We used to go visit my Canadian relatives up in Edmonton, Alberta. And the drive up through, we'd always stop and kind of take a track that would take it through the Rockies and through Yellowstone Park. And I encountered near Butte, Montana, a giant hailstorm and thunderstorm, and that really did it for me. That was, for me, the most interesting thing that ever happened. So from there on, I was about 7 years old, and when I went back, of course, to Southern California, it's very boring weather. But there's even, if you look carefully, there's things to always find. And just about anywhere on the globe that, you know, there's some pretty boring places. But on the other hand, there's things like Santa Ana winds and mountain thunderstorms, desert thunderstorms, and so forth. So that's what kind of did it for me. I was really into, of course, you know, catastrophic weather, weather hazards, that kind of thing. And that's what started it for me. And I went into the Army, and then from there into the National Weather Service, kind of bounced around the country, and then decided to head to the Northeast. And here I am.
And, Jay, what route did you take?
I've kind of been a purebred weather weenie from start and stay in the profession. And I went to undergraduate in New Hampshire, and then I went to graduate school at the University of Utah. Got to experience some real mountains out there. And then I wanted to live where there was four seasons and mountains and have to teach atmospheric science and meteorology. And I found a job at Linden State College in 2005. And I've been there ever since, and I get to now take my passion and spread that forward, you know, pay it forward in a way. And I was a first and family college student, and our mission really is access-oriented, so I really feel like I am paying it forward on many levels.
Well, Linden State, now NVU Linden, has a great program. So tell us about that. I mean, I know there were so many wonderful meteorologists who have come through there.
Yeah, we have a program that's nearly 50 years old now. We've educated more meteorologists in New England than any other school has, and that most people may know us through the eyes of broadcasting, but we have many graduates who work at the National Weather Service and other private industry applications, and the department's been one of the fixture professional programs at the institution since 1973.
Jay, what kind of skill set is important for someone interested in entering the field?
I think, like anything else, you've got to have the passion and the interest. Like Roger and I were talking about, that natural curiosity and just being drawn to the power of nature, right? If you don't have that, you're probably not going to survive some of the more technical math and science-oriented components of the curriculum. So the other thing you need is definitely a more of a math and science brain. There's calculus courses, physics courses, and some students fight through them. Other students have a natural aptitude for them, but you've got to have at least some general abilities in the sciences if you're going to succeed there. And the other area, I think this is more universal just generally in our world, the skill sets I think that are developing and more important are communication and people who are good at communicating complex information in simple ways.
Wow. Calculus. Boy, taking me back to derivatives, I think. 244-1777, a toll-free number, 877-291-8255. That's how you can join the conversation. And we've got Shrimp from Cabot. Good morning, Shrimp. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hey, guys. How are you doing this morning? It's always great to hear Roger's forecast. I mean, we depend on it more than you can imagine. And I would imagine that there's not too many people in the WDEV listening audience who realize that Roger Hill is a fantastic drummer. he plays drums like you wouldn't believe. And I always wondered, Roger, when are you going to put together a drum lead-in for your forecast? Because I just have the feeling that everybody, when they hear you playing the drums, they know, Roger's on with the weather. Come on, get around the radio. And I have a second question before you jump into that.
All right.
We have the phenomenon called flash of beauty when the sun goes down. Is that something we see up here in Vermont at all?
All right. Hey, Shrimp, thanks for the call. Okay, first of all, Roger, when are we going to hear that drum solo leading into your weather?
Well, I don't know. I kind of messed with that idea one time, but I don't think it worked out too well. So, but thanks, Shrimp. I appreciate the appreciate that. But Shrimp, by the way, is a fantastic drummer. And not only that, he can play guitar and drum at the same time with one drumstick.
Oh, my. Well, now that's impressive.
And sing very well. I can't do any of that. So.
All right. But he did ask about the flash of beauty and if it occurs in Vermont. And first of all, tell people what that is and let us know if we can see it somewhere. Who wants to take that one? Jay?
Well, on the ocean, you're talking about when the sun sets and when the when it's the sunset in a clear horizon with good visibility, I guess, a nice clarity. There's this little kind of green thing that kind of happens. I was stationed when I was in the Army, where I kind of learned my trade. I've looked for it many, many times. I've never actually seen it. I suspect you're not going to see it in Vermont because we have obviously a landscape and the horizon is just not going to work. If Lake Champlain was 12 miles in width or longer or something, and it was flat on the other side and it's not in the Adirondacks, obviously, you might try to see that. But I'll let Jay handle the technical side of that.
Okay.
Yeah, the green flash. Right before the sun goes below the horizon, there's an optics phenomena that can happen where briefly you get a green appearance from the sun. And I think the best place to see that, it can happen anywhere in the world, but you do need a nice flat view of the horizon. The best place to possibly see that might be on top of a mountain. I know it's been observed from the top of Mount Washington, for example. It's not something that I've ever seen, but it is one of those cool little phenomena that does happen in the sun.
All right, I've got one on both of you because I have indeed seen it. I live down in Miami, and when you go down to Duval Street in Key West, everybody gets together for the sunset, and there's a big party going on, and that's where I was able to see it several times. So,
right on.
Yeah, pretty neat. All right, I hope this isn't asking you all to reveal a trade secret. I'm going to start with Roger, but how do you create a forecast?
Well, I kind of look at the analysis kind of top down and then apply the modeling. And a lot of the credit that, I get a lot of credit, for weather forecasting and whatnot, but I want to take that credit and give it to the modelers. The modelers are the special folks who try to figure out and put all the variables of our atmosphere that's changing, the fluid dynamics, the changes that are going on constantly. And although we're not perfect at it, these models are amazing. They're getting much and much better all the time, with more analysis, more data input going into that. So I'm, really focused on the forward-looking models and then trying to apply what that model might have done in the past and how the terrain interacts with the flow, if it's a south wind or north wind versus a east or west wind and so forth. There's different components that take place, and you try to put your sort of lifetime experiences and to visualize, and I would underline that word, to visualize the weather when what the model's showing and try to think about how that is and how it's happened in the past. And I'll let Jay go for it.
So I get out my crystal ball and I roll the dice.
There we go. It was simple.
In all honesty, the advancement of weather forecasting is one of the most significant scientific advancements of last century, and I don't think it gets the credit and respect that it deserves oftentimes. And I'm often focused more on how do people use the information that is available from weather forecast models, because they are pretty skillful. And then how do you get people to use that information to make better decisions from it? I think that's really where our science is at, more so than getting the forecast right. Obviously, you're not going to get a forecast perfect beyond about 5-7 days in New England. But you can be pretty skillful relying a lot on the weather forecast models that Roger mentioned within of a week ahead window. Mm. And there is definitely forecaster experience and some rules of thumb to follow there. But a lot of that is being superseded by just the advancement of science and technology. So we solve Newton's second law of motion, force equals mass and acceleration, in a much more sophisticated manner in partial differential equations. And that's all. And then we use that information to derive the forward motion or the forward time prediction of the future.
Jay, when I say Kukuras, what does that mean to you?
Oh, so it's pronounced Kokoraz.
Kokoraz, okay.
Yeah. Which is a funky acronym for Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Project. And that's the largest citizen science weather observing project in the country, where people put out a rain gauge to measure precipitation that falls from the sky. And in Vermont, we've got about 100 active observers. Today, 62 people actually reported in on how much rain fell overnight. So I actually coordinate that program in Vermont, and Roger's part of that effort as well. And their eyes and to the weather, and it helps us actually get more understanding of how Vermont's weather varies and how we can ultimately make better predictions for the future. So we really appreciate all of our observers. If there's any observers listening, thank you very much. And we always welcome new people who are interested in participating. And if you mentioned that you heard me here today, we'll actually get you rain gauge to another partnership. We could ship you one at no cost.
Oh, how
get
cool.
You set up.
How does somebody get involved, Jay?
Yeah, so they can go to the webpage, which is cocorahs.org, or just put in Citizen Science Weather Observations, and you could sign up there. And once you sign up, I'll get a message that you signed up for Vermont, and then we could take it from there.
Oh, I love it. Are there a lot of citizen science opportunities in weather interacting like that?
Yeah, there's different programs. The National Weather Service has some programs for storm spotters, and they'll have some trainings for them. They have a Skywarn program. So anyone from the public can submit weather reports to the National Weather Service, and they have a few programs where people who might be a little more enthusiastically involved to be able to do that. But the COCORAS program really is the largest one that's independently organized that's been around now 20 years.
And one of these days I'll learn how to pronounce it, Jay, I promise.
No worries.
We've got a call from Stephen in Montpelier. Stephen, thanks for calling Vermont Viewpoint. Go right ahead.
Yeah, my question, years ago, I studied botany and ecology with Bill Nearing at Connecticut College, and he had the theory that every 11 years there would be a shift of drought and rain from east to west coast. And I was wondering if that theory still holds, or if anything has been known, if anything's known about that.
Hmm. It's a great question, Stephen. Who wants to take that?
Well, I can say that the sunspot cycle is an 11-year cycle, but I'm not aware of you know, astronomically that seeing, you know, is it that tuned to I'm guessing probably not, but, you know, maybe we don't know all the data. But at the same time, I don't know. It's a good question. I don't really have a good answer for that. Maybe Jay can speak to that.
Yeah, I would say that a lot of the West Coast weather variability follows some of the El Nino-La Nina pattern variability.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not necessarily an 11-year time scale. That varies anywhere from 3 to about 7 years. And that explains a lot of the warmer, dry years there. But there's, I think the key point here is that there's a lot of factors that can control that year-to-year variability that aren't just based off of El Nino or La Nina, and those are just indexes of the Pacific Ocean temperature in the tropical area. So, you know, there are things we don't know, but I think there are things that we know enough to know that it's probably not just one thing.
Yep.
All right, I'm going to give you two an opportunity to ask each other a question. So I'm going to start with Jay, and you ask a weather question of our friend Roger Hill.
Oh, I love it. Roger, what's your favorite storm you've ever experienced?
Oh.
Well, I do love thunderstorms. I love, you know, anything that, you know, it's like, why do people go see a waterfall, you know? It's because it's the power of nature. I think maybe the blizzard of 93, or I happen to be an observer at the Montpelier Airport where I saw the shift after me actually had thunder snow for about 4 hours in a row at Montpelier. I think we picked up 28 inches. If you remember, they shut down the interstate well ahead of that. I mean, everything was pretty much closed up because the modeling was amazing. It was one of these kind of classic Miller A type nor'easters that kind of form in the Gulf of Mexico, like New Orleans area there, kind of cuts across Florida. It did produce a really bad shot of severe weather through Florida with the strong thunderstorms, and the front went all the way down to Nicaragua. It was just a giant storm, and then it worked up the East Coast, and it was just what the models were showing 5 days out. It was amazing how it tracked, and it did produce all the snow that was forecast. It was a classic. I imagine the blizzard of 1888 was a lot bigger one for sure, but I guess I wasn't alive then. But that is probably my best snow experience. And so I would say the 93, the blizzard of 93, which was supposed to be the biggest storm of the century, I think, at the time.
Wow. All right, now you have the opportunity to ask a question of Dr. J.
So I know that you were out in Salt Lake City, Dr. J, and the Wasatch is an amazing, prolific snow-producing mountain range, and it's also with very, very dry snow. I guess my question might be, did you study any of that and orographics in terms of snow and also lake effect snow coming off of the Great Salt Lake? Did you apply into any of that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I know I've always been into mountain weather and snow. And I actually did some of my master's work on understanding how the Wasatch Mountains produces more snowfall and show how that gradient can work, and also situations where the Great Salt Lake can produce enhanced snowfall. My graduate school advisor, Dr. Jim Steinberg, actually wrote a book, The Greatest Snow on Earth, and talked about how Utah has some of the greatest snow on Earth because of its drier climate. The Little Cottonwood Canyon there that gets up to about 11,000 feet and starts at around 5,000 to 6,000 feet has some extreme gradients in snowfall. From the bottom of the canyon, you might get 80 to 100 inches a year. In the top of the canyon at 11,000 feet, just less than 10 miles away, you can get 500 inches a year at Alta ski area. So I did a lot of research on that, and that was fascinating. How extreme the weather can vary with elevation is so much greater than it does in the east.
Excellent. All right, you've asked each other questions. Now we got Mike calling in from Middlesex with a question. Mike, thanks for calling Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, thanks for having me, and love listening to Roger all the time, ever since he's been in the radio. Mine is, the fascination of the Farmer's Almanac. I'm sure you guys, get that hit every once in a while, but to have those, you can read it and how they get to study, a little bit about it, but to hit the accuracy that they do, I think it's pretty accurate. I mean, sometimes they get into 80%, but then, sometimes they even hit actually the 90%. And that's really, I just wanted to hear you guys, kind of perspective on that. And of course, the Almanac's always a great read anyway. So thank you.
Yeah. It is for so many reasons.
I'll jump in there, Mike. I hate to burst your bubble, but the Almanac's a good fiction read. That's about it.
I'm 100% with him. If you point to anytime during the winter and you say there's a really good chance for heavy snow, it's better than 50% chance that you're going to have that. So if you just look at the climatology of what's happening, during a certain part of the year, seasonally, you're going to get some accuracy out of that. And beyond that, I don't really believe in the skill that they claim they have. It takes a little bit longer to try to, let's put it this way. Jay was talking about, El Nino, La Nina, and sometimes we don't know a year out what that's going to do. So I'm not really convinced of the skill accuracy, but a lot of people believe it, and I think it's based more on climatology, but I'll leave it there.
Well, Jay, when did kind of the modern era of meteorology really start to occur where, we didn't have to refer to a Farmer's Almanac to get a general vague sense of what the weather would be?
Benjamin Franklin?
So just looking back at some of the big milestones there, I would say that in the early 1900s, it was shown that you could solve equations of motion to predict the weather, but we didn't have computing power to be able to do that until actually the 1940s and 50s. Some of the first modern weather forecast models were developed in a very simple, primitive way at Princeton University back in the early 1950s. And then we launched the first weather satellite back in the 60s. And I would say the science has been getting better incrementally in a very rapid way, since we had eyes on from space. And then we've been getting better incrementally quite a bit since then. So better than the Farmer's Almanac, I think, for quite some time. I would say at least two generations. Now, that said, when I was a kid, I liked to enjoy it and read it, too, because it always kind of created some hope and optimism and something to think about for the future. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You just don't want to rely on it for a reputable scientific source.
And, Roger, you mentioned Jack of all everything, Ben Franklin. What was his role?
Well, as I understand it, there was a nor'easter, and this is just vague memory here, but he basically determined that a storm that had been in Philadelphia had then gone to Boston. And because he asked people about when it arrived and when did it start snowing or whatever it did at that point, and he determined that the storm moved from southwest to northeast. And I don't think anybody had done that up until that point. And he logged it and through observation. And it goes back to, kind of dovetails back to Kokoroz. It's very important to have all this analysis, all this information of what's happening right now as a snapshot that goes into then the modeling. If we have poor analysis, that is, there's holes in the analysis. Let's give an example. Okay, it's clear in Montpelier and clear in Burlington, but in Waterbury there's a thunderstorm. We want to know about the thunderstorm in Waterbury, so that goes into the analysis. If we have big gaping holes, we have a crappy analysis. So the idea of Kokoroz is to add another, data set into that. And, of course, we have satellite, radar, we have multitudes, we have airplanes flying around that are taking soundings as they take off and travel at high altitude and then descend and so forth. And, by the way, COVID-19 has reduced a lot of that data, so there's a theory that our modeling is not quite as good. So it's a very interesting topic if you want to get into that. But that analysis, anyway, getting back to that snapshot is oh so critical for weather forecasting.
All right. We're going to have to say goodbye, I think, to Jay Schaefer right now. So NVU Linden Professor of Atmospheric Sciences, Jay Schaefer, thanks for being with us. And we'll be back with Roger Hill to talk weather right up to 10 o'clock here on WDEV.
Exciting things are happening in Warren Village. The Pitcher Inn and Warren Store are under new management. Upgrades and improvements are in the works, maintaining the ambiance and character while breathing new energy and resources into these iconic properties. We are open while practicing all CDC protocols. Come for lunch at our Rockin' Deli and see for yourself what the buzz is all about. Both businesses are hiring, especially seeking fine dining room staff and sales associates for our boutique. Still fun, funky, and friendly, but better than ever. Open daily on Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint with Radio Vermont forecaster Roger Hill, and he's still taking your questions or reacting to some weather event that you'd like to share. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can call us at 244-1777 or toll free 877-291-8255. And Roger, we had a call. She couldn't stay on the line, but Nancy in Morristown in Eden called to say hello, loves your forecasting. And she had a question that I'm going to take. I'm not trying to set myself up as a weather guru, but she wanted more information on Kokoroz. So let me tell you what that's all about, Nancy. First of all, it is the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network, and you can access it at COCORAHS.org. COCORAHS.org. Okay, Roger Hill, I had you and Dr. Jay Schaefer ask each other questions, and that was a really neat moment, and it made me wonder how much interaction does go on with the meteorologists. Last hour, we spoke with Howard Norman, the author, and he said, you know, as a writer, we get this, you have this image of us being kind of in a vacuum, but we're not. We interact. So how do meteorologists interact?
Well, there's conferences and things like the National Weather Association and the American Meteorological Association where they report in on the latest papers, the latest findings and whatnot. I don't go to a lot of those. I have been in the past, but so what I like to do is I just kind of read the latest things that do pop up. And unfortunately, Dr. Jay, that's much more in his wheelhouse for research. When you're kind of deep into the trenches in operational meteorology, I have to worry about, of course, the state's utilities through the contract that I do through my company, Weathering Heights, and Velco. And Dr. Jay, by the way, also is involved in some of the utility stuff, too, as well, with Northview Weather. He's working on specific kind of stuff, parameters in meteorology that cause power outages as well. But there's a lot of research component, and then there's a lot of operational component. I'm more of an operational guy. Gotcha. I'm more or less into the trenches. And so what I don't get into a lot of the research except when it's presented to me and it starts to apply with what I'm trying to work with. So there is a lot of collaboration, no doubt about it. There's a fantastic list of some of the most sort of the brain trust of meteorology comes out of SUNY Albany. They're talking to folks that are a part of this list with interesting things going on in North America and other parts of the world. And there's a lot of information out there. And here's the thing, though, you can get lost in all of that when you're in the operational mode. So that's kind of where I guess that's my wheelhouse, is more operational.
Yeah. Let's take another call. We're going to go to Dave from Charlotte. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning.
What's your question?
I have a question for Roger. Channel 3 is telling us that I really shouldn't believe you because they have reporters with 80 years of experience, or maybe 100. I assume they don't have to use weather models anymore. You got any comments on that?
Dave, I just want to make sure. They're not calling Roger Hill out specifically, are
oh,
they
no,
over there?
No, no.
All right.
No. They're just saying that they're the best.
Oh, gotcha. All right. Let's see what Roger has to say about that.
I'm going to stay out of that because that's a PR thing. And, you know, there are no slouches in all of the Vermont TV stations. WPTZ 22 as well as Channel 3 have great folks. A lot of them that have come through Linden State College or Northern Vermont University. And there's some really good, you know, experience is a big deal, I think, in meteorology. You learn the applied stuff early on, and then you try to remember, here again, when I see a storm coming in the modeling, when I look at it, I'm trying to figure out and try to visualize exactly how it's going to take place. But I'm going to leave that one alone. Simply, there's no slouches. They're all really, really good, and they're my colleagues, and I'm not gonna down them anyway. So there you go.
Dave, trying to start a little weather forecaster war here on Vermont Viewpoint, but Roger Hill not taking the bait. Thank you, Roger. But hey, one thing that is very interesting, I mentioned it kind of at the top, but why are Vermonters so captivated with the weather?
Well, our weather is in our face, and you know, somebody who lives in a southern, more, you know, calmer type climate, let's take Southern California, for example. Well, we still have to deal with fires now and Santa Ana winds, and then you get heavy, atmospheric rivers out of the subtropics and stuff like that with El Niños. You still have pretty interesting weather going on. Just about, like I said, just about anywhere you can find interesting aspects to meteorology or the atmospheric flow and whatnot. Up here, we really have, we're higher latitude. It's near 45 north latitude, which runs across the northern part of Vermont. And that's halfway between the equator and the North Pole. And this is where the jet stream and the most changes occur of anywhere on the planet. So both in the northern and southern hemisphere, this is where our oscillations are going to take place the most. And that oscillating weather, whether it's high pressure and fair weather or cold Arctic outbreaks or whatnot, followed by a warming trend and then a cyclonic storm that's going to push in from the Great Lakes, or one that moves up the East Coast as a nor'easter. All of these things are applying in Vermont. And so we get everything. We get a little bit of, you know, tornadic thunderstorm activity, which is probably on the increase over time with climate change. We get a little bit of tropical cyclone activity, you know, Irene. We can think of Isaias that went through here, which seems to be on the increase. And in fact, Dr. Jay just had a really interesting study about that. And we get very strong winds, and of course, it interacts with our north-south mountain ranges. Our terrain is going to cause different things to happen, and downsloping and upsloping and so forth. So getting back to the weather in Vermont is really, it's in our face, and that's why everybody is a weatherman. And nobody can say that, you know, well, you're the weatherman, and you're not.
Right.
So it's one of those kind of situations.
Hey, Roger, I think I use it sometimes interchangeably, and I know I'm wrong. The words weather and climate, what's the difference?
Well, climate is kind of what your wardrobe is for the season, and weather is the day-to-day stuff you're going to wear.
Gotcha. All right. And have you noticed Vermont's climate changing in your time charting it?
No doubt about it. It's not changing as fast as other places in the country, and it's the further north you go, the tendency is that in the Arctic it's changing 2 to 3 times faster. It's called Arctic amplification, and a lot of our weather is being controlled by what's going on up there. But here at 45 north latitude on the eastern side of a continent, and if you can go to any eastern side or western side of a continent, the eastern side has a tendency to be where a lot more extremes are taking place, where there's a little bit more of a moderational effect on the western side of a continent. You can apply that pretty much anywhere. So our weather is just, you know, it just sits in that kind of mode here because of our geology as well as our geography and where we're situated north and south from the equator and the pole.
Now, Roger, I have started something on the morning news service here on WDEV. It's called Hey Roger, Name Our Band, Please. And this is for bands starting out, working hard on their music, but don't have a band name yet. And I've been chatting, I mean, I've been just jotting down things you say that could make great band names. And I've thrown out a few to you already, but I'm just going to run down the list here. Bizarro Climate Niches, Warm Frontal Genesis, there's Bombo Genesis, Zonal Flow, Snow Bunnies, Hate Zonal Flow, Shortwave Troughs, Fringe Effects, A Little Bigger Surge, and Bubble of Higher Pressure, just some of the band names you've come up with so far. But you do use some really wonderful expressive terms and languages, and I know a lot of that is part of the meteorology. But do you really think about it when you're writing a forecast?
No, you know what I'm trying to do is I think try to descriptively find a word that people can relate to, like, you know, patchy valley fog down in the valleys. I look down onto a valley and I can see the fog down there. So maybe it's a little selfish on my end, but I think a great band name would be Apache Fog, but I think it's taken.
All right. No, I love the way you describe it, and I want you to keep doing that because it really does give people a sense of what's going on, and it makes a forecast that much more fun to listen to. We got another call from Fred in Newbury. Fred, good morning.
Morning. Hey, my question is, can you explain a rain shadow, and does Vermont have a rain shadow?
All right.
So, okay, it's about upslope, downslope, which sounds like a PBS series, but it's not. So the flow is coming in from the west. Let's picture that, okay? Mm-hmm. The flow is moving in from the west. It's hitting, crossing the Champlain Valley, and then it hits the Green Mountains. That flow below the mountaintop has to be lifted, okay? So that weather that's going to take place on the western side of the mountains and over the mountain ridge is going to be lifted, and it's going to cause a little extra more precipitation. That's why if you look at an annual rainfall or precipitation map of Vermont, you will notice you can see the Green Mountain spine. You can see the various ranges like the Ludlow Range and the Worcester Range and the Northfield Range and the Roxbury Range and so forth, and then the Groton Forest, the Standard Mountains. Well, all these different ranges have this variation. So what ends up happening is the flow immediately that is lifted produces precipitation, and then all of a sudden it has to descend the mountain in a what we consider a stable flow, not sort of convectively stable or whatever. So you're looking at a kind of situation where the downsloping wind then dries everything out. And so you get much less rainfall on the other side of that mountain range. And that is a typical downsloping, and that is what we call a rain shadow. So if you look at a better kind of situation, might be the Sierra Nevada out in California. That flow, again, is coming off the Pacific, a lot of moisture. It has to be the ascent of that flow will produce precipitation, and then immediately hits the crust of the Sierra. And then it has to descend again, and that descending air is basically a rain shadow. And the shadowing effect means things are drying out. That takes place, by the way, depending on the flow for the White Mountains. When there's a southeasterly flow, there's a magnificent rain shadow that extends even into the Northeast Kingdom. Sometimes the rain shadows over Mount Mansfield will extend across my area around Worcester. It'll sort of steal and rob that moisture that might have fallen on the mountain range. And so all these mountains we're looking at in Vermont, and even some of the lower mountain ranges or higher hills, if you will, have this sort of upslope, downslope component taking place. Not always. It depends on how stable the atmosphere is in the lowest part of the troposphere, but that interaction produces rain shadows.
I'm glad you took that one, Roger, because I was going to say it's an old Cat Stevens song. Rain shadow. Moon shadow. Yeah, right. Okay, let's take another call. Bill is calling from Barrie. Good morning, Bill. Thanks for calling us here at Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Roger. What I like about you is you explain it when you're giving it to. I watch Channel 3 and watch their weather, and I like it, but you did all these different things that you're saying today. What I wanted to say, I've got family that live in both in the West Coast and in Florida. And the ones in Florida say how harsh our weather is. But I'm saying our weather, I think, is the safest you can get in the country. It seems that way to me. We don't have hurricanes, and we don't have all this other kind of stuff. And we don't have as many floods as they do. And that's my opinion. Do you agree with me that we have the safest weather?
I kind of do because, we get what we consider extreme big snowstorms. And as I was talking about, the weather's in your face with the cold blasts and whatnot. But we don't get the, you might say, the marginal fringe high extreme level of stuff, whereas Florida does. A hurricane or tropical storm Eta just went west of Tampa Bay. By the way, our old colleague Dana Jewell, who's down in Florida, he called me last night and was worried about a little bit of storm surge working in the Tampa Bay region there. So, he's experiencing some of the weather we're not getting. But you know, when you do put a well organized tropical cyclone into Vermont like Hurricane Irene, you got to remember that all that water that might be 6 inches is now culminating down into the valleys, and so that 6 inches of water is not like on a flat plain in Florida. That 6 inches of water now is washing out, you know, bridges, covered bridges that have been there for 150 years or whatever.
Right.
So that's what happened with Irene. So we can still get some pretty heavy duty extremes, but in a general sense, our weather is sort of within the margins, outside or sort of within the extremes, if you will.
Yeah. I lived in South Florida. Luckily, in my 11 years down there, never had a hurricane hit. But I will say I have to agree with Bill's assessment. It does seem much more safe here as far as weather is concerned. He brings up hurricanes, and this has been a record hurricane season, Roger. Why is that happening?
Oh, it's an amazing season. We are living through historical times, but the worry is that it will repeat again. Well, it's a combination of a La Nina, which is the subtropical Pacific Ocean. It's funny because we're talking about the Atlantic hurricane season, but we have to look to the subtropical Pacific Ocean. And what Dr. Jay was talking about is this oscillation called El Nino Southern Oscillation. So we have El Nino, and then the opposite is La Nina. And when we go into a cold phase of ENSO or La Nina, it basically causes the subtropical jet over the Atlantic Ocean to vacate, and that allows the development of hurricanes or tropical depressions and tropical storms, and then a hurricane to basically become fairly circular in nature. It doesn't shear off the tops. When you have an El Nino going on, it's a harder aspect because the subtropical jet blowing across these same areas where hurricanes are produced that come off the west coast of Africa and then ship westward, it just kind of destroys them because it shears them to death. And if you have too much shear, a hurricane is going to die. It can't happen. Well, we have no shear, and we have extra heavy-duty tropical sea surface temperatures that are anomalously warm. And it's these extra warm temperatures. You put those two together, and you're coming up with the, you know, Greek letters. And unfortunately, we're not done. I have a feeling Iota, or I think it's pronounced Yoda, it's spelled IOTA, is probably something we're going to be looking at that's going to go right toward the same places around Nicaragua and Honduras. It's going to be down in the southwestern Caribbean, probably not curl north, at least the latest computer modeling shows that, but we're not done with hurricane season 2020 here. It may go into Christmas. We don't know.
Oh, boy. Well, you touched on this morning in your forecasting. You were talking about looking ahead to what winter will be like this year. So give us an idea of what we can expect here in the North Country.
There's a lot of really good research, and here again, I'm not a researcher, so I read what the research is, and I kind of figured out, but Dr. Judah Cohen of MIT, he has kind of developed some interesting aspects for long-range winter forecasting, and he's a big snow lover, so he took an interest in it like that. But needless to say, it has to do with the polar vortex, and what goes on up in the Arctic Ocean in the polar region has a lot to do with how our weather behaves during the winter. And so when the polar vortex is very, very strong, which is the indications that it'll continue to do this into, say, January, we'll probably have warmer than normal temperatures, probably way less snowfall compared to normal. And we'll still get snow, not like we're not going to see snow, and we'll still get cold bouts, but they won't be as plentiful, let's put it that way. And if you weaken that polar vortex and get the opposite, which is a negative version of the Arctic Oscillation, that is a weak polar vortex, it allows all that cold Arctic air to rush down toward where? 45 north latitude. Guess where Vermont is? That's when we have nor'easter after nor'easter after nor'easter. So at some point this winter, probably more backloaded, I suspect that we'll get into a negative AO, which will produce that colder air, which will come, it'll kind of ooze on down from the Arctic, and then it'll set up a weather pattern where we have what we call the baroclinic zone, which is the hot air clashing with the cold air. We hear about this all the time with spring tornadoes out in the Midwest and so forth. That is called the baroclinic zone, where you have the clashes of the air masses. That's when, and cold air coming out of the Arctic next to relatively warm air. The oceans are warming, as I was talking about, due to climate change. Well, you produce these tremendous storms, and we're seeing an increase in this, but we don't have the setup, particularly, it looks like, going into January.
Roger, you mentioned earlier that big storm, there was thunder snow, 4 hours of thunder snow. What exactly is that, and what causes it?
Well, it's so much upward vertical motion in the atmosphere. Well-developed snowfall will produce this. Generally a nor'easter or an inland cyclone. You can get convection even though the temperatures are below freezing, and all the way down to surface, i.e., snow, frozen precipitation is falling. So, it's the same dynamic that you have in a summer thunderstorm, except that it's much lower in altitude. For example, even the Great Lakes, when they produce a really strong lake effect snowband that goes through Buffalo off of Lake Erie, or let's say it hits the Tug Hill Plateau, you can get isolated lightning and get a little bit of thunder snow now and then. And very well-developed cyclones like the blizzard of 93, we carried in Montpelier 4 hours of occasional lightning, and it's a very odd kind of weird kind of orange, blue, purple kind of color to it. It's not like and it's mostly intra-cloud lightning. I don't think it reaches the ground very much, but it's there, and it sure is a rare phenomenon. And I know there's a Linden State graduate, everybody knows him as Jim Cantore on the Weather Channel. He revels for this. By the way, a Vermonter.
Love it.
He's from the Norwich region. So, this is, I remember carrying, or the ship before me, or after me, I think it was, carried 4 hours of thundersnow at the Barry Montpelier EF Napa Airport.
Wow. Roger Hill, pleasure to have you here on Vermont Viewpoint. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs, directed by Peter Cormier, and I'm Rick Singeri, and I'll meet you back here tomorrow.